to CPRcommunitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As we've reported earlier, the U.S. representative to NATO on Tuesday essentially threatened a preemptive strike against Russian missiles that she claimed violate the INF Treaty. For more on that and on relations between the U.S. and Russia generally, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University and former U.S. Navy guy. We spoke with him from Moscow via Skype Friday. So, Mark, let's start with Kay Bailey Hutchison, the former governor and senator from Texas, Republican, who is the one that made the threat.
Her threat to preemptively attack Russia.
We're going to take out those missiles.
Yeah, this was during a NATO Ministers of Defense, Defense Ministry summit in Europe, in Brussels. And discussion was on a alleged Russian weapons system, a missile by the goes by the designation NM729, and this is supposedly a land-based cruise missile, launched from land, a guided land cruise missile that is a variation on Russia's sea-based caliber cruise missile, which has seen recent operation in Syria to some good evidence that it has been a highly successful system. The U.S. is accusing that there is a land-based variation of this missile that Russia has developed and has actually deployed in at least two locations, if for testing purposes, that the missile if land-based, violates the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty between Russia and the U.S. And this would put it at somewhere, a range somewhere between 620 and 3,420 miles range. Now, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty was a treaty agreed to in 1987 by then Gorbachev and Reagan. And the basic idea of the threat was to remove the threat of these, you know, shorter range missiles. We're not talking intercontinental ballistic missiles. We're talking shorter range missiles capable of launching nuclear weapons that would basically obliterate Europe and the Russia west of the Urals. These could be fired quickly. Mm-hmm. There was less possibility for reaction time, and they were viewed as at the time as relatively dangerous by both sides, and that getting rid of them would make Europe safer. So the treaty has largely been upheld until about the last decade. And there are some indications, as Russia has pointed out, Russia has accused the U.S. of multiple violations of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty.
Right.
And they point towards several different ways. The first and most serious probably has to do with the U.S. anti-ballistic missile defense shield,
right,
in Europe, particularly in Poland and Romania, elements in Poland and Romania. And this ballistic missile defense shield that the U.S. has put up in Europe uses the Aegis Ashore system with an MK-41 launcher. Now, these launchers are used at sea as well as defense to launch offensive cruise missiles, and it seems the Russian accusation is, and it seems every credible expert has on both sides says that it is at least possible that it would be a matter of minutes, up to a few hours, to reconfigure these to launch ground-based cruise missiles, which would fall into that intermediate range category.
Right.
So that not only is the missile defense there, for which the U.S. pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile defense treaty unilaterally,
right,
in 2001, but that that was then George W. Bush, but that then these supposed missile defense launchers could actually launch offensive intermediate range weapons, and that they're basically already deployed on Russia's borders. Some of the other accusations that Russia says is the U.S. use of armed drones, the fact that these drones don't have pilots,
right,
and are capable of carrying nuclear missiles if stationed in Europe, that these are also violations of the treaty. They point towards what the U.S. calls test missiles, that it particularly, we're looking at the Hera missile and a couple other possibilities that the U.S. uses to test their anti-ballistic missile defense shield. They are essentially intermediate range missiles that are fired and then supposedly intercepted by the anti-ballistic missile defense capabilities.
Right.
But using these test missiles, Russia says the U.S. actually really has a ready supply of intermediate range missiles that are capable of being deployed at a moment's notice. And the treaty, it does not ban the research and development.
Right.
It does ban the manufacture, possession, and it includes the launchers as well as the missiles themselves. Those are the terms of the treaty. And the U.S. is accusing Russia of being in violation. The U.S. back is accusing Russia of being in violation with this new missile. And they say that they have intelligence that it's been deployed to two places in Russia including one in the south near Volgograd and one further to the east. Now, Russia's position on the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty is that once the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Defense Treaty and didn't uphold their international obligations, that the treaty is really no longer in Russia's strategic interests. One, because of the nature of missile defense erected in Europe, which threatens Russia's nuclear deterrent, the potential offensive capability, again, of these missile defense launchers, and the fact that multiple Asian countries now have intermediate range missiles. Within striking distance, of course, of Russia, of much of Russia, that are not a party to this treaty. Putin has basically said that, you know, we're continuing to observe this, but we basically reserve the right at some point to unilaterally pull out of this, just like you unilaterally pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Defense Treaty, which Russia kind of regards as the most important original sin since, you know, other than perhaps the expansion of NATO itself.
Yeah, I mean, there's a strategic context to all of this just based on the geography alone. So, but we can get to that. Go ahead.
So, my reading of this is that both countries are probably in violation of the treaty. Neither one is yet willing to pull out of it, because while both countries are probably violating it, they're violating it, shall we say, still largely respecting it. They are violating it in some small ways.
Right, discreetly.
But discreetly. But if both sides pulled out, you know, or if the treaty, you know, what if somebody pulled out and the treaty was annulled, then that might spark a new intermediate range weapon arms race. And there's every indication of exactly that, because the U.S. this year, within its National Defense Authorization Act, basically the military budget, has allocated, I believe, some $58 million towards developing exactly a land-launched guided cruise missile that would specifically fall within the ranges of the treaty. And this is for research and development of overtly of such a system, that if they say that if Russia, they determine that Russia continues to be in violation, they will then just go ahead and build these things, and they will already be ready to be built, which probably means they already are being built.
Right.
But, you know, that's the way. So, but this rhetoric that we heard coming out of Kelly of Hutchinson is really quite amazing. She specifically used the phrase, we have to take out.
Yeah, she was pressed on it twice by a reporter also.
Right. She was a reporter, you know, taken aback because he realized what she was saying, you know, asked her again. And, you know, what type of countermeasures are you talking? And her said the countermeasures would be to take out those missiles. And those of us, probably most of us out there who are native English speakers, to take out something has a very specific connotation, especially when used within a military context. She immediately after this summit walked this back, saying that she didn't mean to suggest that the U.S. was considering a preemptive attack on Russia, which is exactly not only how Russia interpreted it, but how U.S. reporters and security people interpreted it. And I'm thinking specifically the first time I saw even mention of it, I wasn't watching, who watches these things as they're happening unless something important is said. Robbie Gramer, who is a security and national defense reporter for Foreign Policy, he tweeted right out that she was making a preemptive attack threat.
Right.
And so I mean, it wasn't just, oh, Russia interpreted this wrong. No, it's pretty obvious from her conversation that what she meant was to take out Russia's, weapons site. And I hate to tell you, but you don't take out Russia's missiles without starting World War III.
Yeah, for sure.
Because Russia is, probably the only other country on the planet with the nuclear capability to also destroy the United States. The fact that we're living in this post-Cold War era with no rules, and it's increasingly becoming the fact that not only are the Cold War rules, many of them are outdated when dealing with cyber warfare and space and some other things, but what Cold War era treaties that kept the peace, as it were, at least between the two, the two great powers involved, are all rapidly fading. The New START treaty it expires in 2021, and the Trump administration has indicated that the U.S. doesn't want to continue it. The NATO Russia Founding Act it exists in paper only now. It's obviously being violated, as is the conventional Armed Forces in Europe treaty, the INF treaty. We can talk later if we get to it about the Biological Weapons Convention, which may be being violated right now. U.S. accuses Russia of violating the Chemical Weapons Convention.
Right.
All of these Cold War treaties that provided a degree, at least, of rules of if we follow the rules and respect each other, to this amount, then we provide a degree of reliability and safety between two enemies that could destroy each other and the whole world with them. Well, all of these are going out the window. They're going out, they're eroding, they're fading, they're being pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile treaties, another one. And with Trump unilaterally pulling out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action that was just agreed to by all of the major world powers and solidified with a UN Security Council resolution, it shows once again that the exceptional nation, doesn't believe that it's bound by international law. And Trump administration Bolton's recent threats to not only, not adhere to the International Criminal Court, but to actually go after the International Criminal Court, to attempt to defund it, and to make personal attacks on the finances and travel ability of any judges or prosecutors involved who would dare to bring pending cases against the United States and Israel.
Yeah, Bolton sounds like Dutch Schultz or something. He's a maniac.
It's crazy. Not only, can't you dare to judge us, never mind that, we're all more than happy to use the International Criminal Court on the countries that the leaders of the country we defeat. We're threatening to go after the judges, the prosecutors involved. And they also even said any state organization or company that facilitates such.
That's right.
Sanctions for everybody.
That's right. Kneecaps.
They're talking suing them in court. Everything. And this is Bolton has previously when during the first Trump the first the administration he was in, the George W. Bush administration, when the U.S. was pushing to war on Iraq on the pretext of nuclear of weapons of mass destruction, Trump was threatening UN and UN officiated officials, OPCW, that if you don't resign, then we will go after you, and making comments, that I believe have been recorded. It's certainly been reported by the officials involved that he said, we know where your kids live. You're in New York.
You said Trump? Or are you talking about Bush?
No, we're talking about Bolton.
Oh, Bolton. Bolton. Yeah.
He's the connect. I mean, obviously, he's brought back into power. He was making these accusations, you know, basically threatening like a mafia.
Like I said, he's like Dutch Schultz. He's not just like a mafia. He's like crazy mafia. He's insane.
I have to admit, I have no idea who Dutch Schultz is.
Oh, yeah, that's why. Yeah, he was at the council, you know, of mobsters or whatever. He was like the wild buncher. The rest of them were... And we're businessmen, you know. So, listen, I want to go to this to the context where people understand some things, because some treaties matter more to one side than the other, and these are based on geography and also on the balance of the other forces. For Russia, first of all, the intermediate range nuclear forces treaty, the INF treaty, came into being in response to the cruise missiles that had been deployed, particularly in Germany. It started in the late 70s, deployed actually, I think, in 1983, finally, in Germany. I remember standing in Moscow in 1990 with my friend Paul, and he was pointing to the main government buildings, the sisters' buildings, and describing, essentially, he said, well, in the event of a nuclear attack, the hotshots that are on the top floors of these buildings have an 18-minute elevator ride from the top to the bottom to a hardened, safe facility. The problem is, it's 12 minutes from launch to detonation here, from launch in Germany. So, the government was operating under a state of siege from deployment. So the cruise missiles, these, medium-range missiles, mattered an awful lot. Medium-range missiles launched from anywhere in Russia maybe can hit Sarah Palin's house. Maybe can hit Seattle, perhaps, but that's about it. Otherwise, they need intercontinental ballistic missiles to do that.
They were a threat to Europe, but not to most of the United States.
And then the other has to do with the anti-ballistic missile system. Now, Russia's nuclear deterrent is based in Russia. And so surrounding Russia with enemy nations, which is what's been happening since 1993, basically, means at deploying those weapons so that anything shot from Russia can be shot down. In other words, negating Russia's nuclear deterrence, and Russia doesn't have a geographical opportunity to do the same thing unless it does some atmospheric kinetic weapon or something.
Let's look at where that's being done. In South Korea, in Poland, in Romania, there's elements in the United Kingdom, there's elements in Alaska. There's a variety of seaborne elements that can be deployed anywhere as needed. Now, obviously, that's a ring around Russia. I mean,
look at a map. I mean, for sure. Yeah. And then you have, in addition to that, by the way, if we're going to talk about treaty obligations, the Non-Proliferation Treaty under Article 6 required not just, Iran and North Korea can't, new nations can't get nuclear weapons, we don't want proliferation. It also had an affirmative obligation on the parties to A, stop growing the nuclear arsenals, B, reduce them to zero, and C, begin and accomplish total disarmament.
Yeah, and it has to be said that none of the nuclear armed major powers have begun that anyway. Everyone is in violation of that around the boards. And we created a two-tier international system with the top tier countries that have nuclear weapons, and the West was more than happy, speaking of non-proliferation, to add Israel to their side with nuclear weapons, and no one, of course, has ever taken any actions against Israelis' nuclear arsenal.
No inspection, not a party to any regime, nothing. They're wild, wild out there.
I want to stress why the anti-ballistic missile treaty pullout was so serious for Russia, in the post-Cold War era, because Russia's conventional forces, were always behind the U.S., but at on a global scale, but at least in Europe, Russia had a if for combat in Europe, Russia had a numerical superiority, particularly with tanks and so on, at least in the short term, the idea that then they could prevent the U.S. from getting resupply of forces to Europe. That's the Tom Clancy Red Storm Rising scenarios, everything like that. But in the post-Cold War era, Russia's not only geography and geopolitical horizons, but its military forces are reduced. You know, there's no question that Russia has made leaps and bounds to modernizing its military in the last 10, 12 years. You know, most international rank, every international I've ranking in the world still puts Russia as number two military power in the world after the United States. That said, they simply lack power projection. You know, recent developments in Georgia and Ukraine and elsewhere have raised the specter that, that Russia, you know, particularly in Ukraine, a lot of criticism in Russia is we can't even defend the, you know, the countries in our near abroad. Russia's conventional capability is much less, you know, despite all these advances overall, than the United States.
Right.
Which means Russia relies more for its security, particularly against an aggressive West that is blocking off countries around the world whenever, you know, it gets an opportunity and a feeling to do so, that it needs its nuclear deterrent to provide for its defense against what it sees as an aggressive U.S. and NATO far more than U.S. actually relies on its nuclear weapons for a deterrent, being the dominant conventional power on the planet anyway.
This is the main context, by the way, is this: the Russia is not and has no interest in raising a threat to invade the United States or to destroy the United States or Europe. And so meanwhile, the United States has a massive military budget at the same time that it has been forward-directing aggression and hostility towards Russia. So to the extent that it is a huge impact on the American and West European and Japanese and Korean economies, and if Russia elects not to do that, in other words, let's not be a wartime economy, then the only way they can defend themselves against this monster at the moment is with nuclear weapons. It's cheaper.
Yeah. And let's be clear, you know, Russia did increase its military spending. You know, it's still a less than a tenth of what U.S. military spending is. Did increase the military spending over the last, 5 years.
Right.
And that the goal of that was simply modernization to catch up from the lag that occurred in the 90s when the U.S. was continuing to advance and Russia wasn't. But now that that modernization has been viewed to be largely achieved, the U.S., the Russian military defense budget is now going down. It went down last year, and it will go down further this year.
Right.
And at the same time, you know, Trump is having a huge military defense budget increase and pushing the country, the rest of the European countries of NATO, to increase their military spending as well. You know, Russia doesn't want Poland. Russia doesn't want the Baltics,
right?
You couldn't pay Russia to take Poland back. That's Russia's like, whoo, we got rid of that one. EU, that's your problem now.
Yeah, it's almost like a reverse of 1939 at this point, 1938, in that Russia's like, here, Germany, you take it. Germany, like, no, you take it.
The threat of conventional conflict, and which could always spiral into strategic conflict between Russia and the U.S., is always the situation of countries in Russia's periphery, whether we're talking Ukraine, Belarus, Georgia, Kazakhstan. As far afield, Russia's geopolitical horizons don't extend any further than Syria, which is still 24 hours by jeep from Russia's vulnerable southern underbelly, as they call it, you know, where, which Russia really did not need to see Damascus fall and Al-Qaeda or Ahrar al-Sham or Jaish al-Islam start a Islamic caliphate in Syria, which is basically what is happening right now in Idlib under U.S. and Turkish protection. But
and very quickly, tell us what's going on in the Republic of Georgia, former Soviet republic.
There is a joint Georgian-U.S. biomedical facility a brand new facility, supposedly in Georgia, built on a former military base, you know, a place with no former medical research. And it's called, get this, the Richard Lugar Center for Public Health Research in Georgia, right? And we're not talking Georgia, the right. U.S. state. We're talking Georgia, you know,
the Republic of Georgia,
next to Russia. Yeah. But Russia has accused, is making accusations that the U.S. may be conducting bio warfare research there to get out of more stringent oversight that it might prevent it from being done within the United States. And they're pointing to a number of people who have died. This is a center just a few kilometers outside of the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. 73 people have died, at least 73, in recent days there, including 24 in one day.
Yep.
And then 27 in one day, sorry. And then you know, another 40-some died. And the official story is that they died during treatment for Sovaldi, which is a treatment, potential treatment for hepatitis C, and that they were conducting human trials. Interestingly, trials being conducted in Russia have resulted in no deaths attributed.
That's interesting. And here's something that's also ironic. The Nunn-Lugar Act, this is the actual Senator Richard Lugar from Indiana's work in the Senate. He was one of the people, that act was done to dismantle biological weapons, among other things, around the world. So there's a deep irony there.
Anyway, the accusations that the U.S. is conducting research there were actually from a Georgian former security minister who has released hundreds of thousands of pages of documents, secret documents online that have all kind of links to the U.S. conducting research with hemorrhagic fever there, weaponizing mosquitoes to carry toxins.
Right.
Hollow point bullets that could contain chemical or biological agents.
Yep.
And there's this all this talk about the U.S. developing genetic warfare, with the Air Force having a database specifically of ethnic Russian genetic material.
Yep, I know. All right, we're going to maybe have to pick it up there next week. Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Washington's ambassador to NATO threatens to take out Russian missiles, and the U.S. Interior Secretary threatens a naval blockade of Russia. Is the Trump doctrine finally being revealed? Talking some real news, I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And we have Glenn Deason. He is a professor at the Higher School of Economics. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Glenn, let me go to you first here. We have this Kay Bailey Hutchinson, the American ambassador to NATO. She had a little, well, she got into a bit of a scrap, threatening to take out Russian missiles. What's the backstory and what's it mean?
Well, the reason why she wanted to take out the Russian missiles is because, they're arguing Russia's developing new missiles, which goes counter to the INF treaty.
Which is for our viewers?
Medium-range missiles. So, but, I guess in her defense, afterwards she did try to walk it back, but in the process she actually made it a lot worse, because her argument essentially was that, oh no, it's not a first strike, we merely want to take out the Russian missiles. We're not gonna attack Russian cities. And this is quite astonishing. And again, this defense was also put forward in Washington Post, which is quite extraordinary, because the whole purpose of a first strike, of course, is to use precision weapons and tactical nuclear weapons to take out the adversary's weapons. Yeah, so they can't retaliate. It's the second strike capabilities that have the intention of actually attacking big cities to make as big damage as possible, and because that's the deterrent, so the other side won't do a first strike. Now,
You're saying she doesn't really know what she's talking about.
Well, there's two possible explanations. One, the first would be is mind-boggling incompetency. The second would be it's deliberate, possibly propaganda in terms of essentially advancing a first strike policy, but essentially under a very ambiguous, conceptually ambiguous, just in terms of what
is a first strike. Receiving end of it, it's much more than just a statement here. It shows an intentionality, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, the attempt to walk this statement back is obviously second. It comes after the fact. It's post-facto. Because during the conference, she said the need to take out these missiles. And then she answered a second question from a journalist who said, we're a little excited here. Could you specify whether you want these missiles withdrawn or whether you mean something a little more military and literal? And she said, well, we would prefer to have them withdrawn, but we have to talk about countermeasures if they are not withdrawn. And she doubled down and she said, take them out again.
Okay, let me quote her here. Yeah. So, my point, Russia needs to return to INF treaty compliance, or we will need to match its capabilities to protect U.S. and NATO interests. The current situation with Russia in blatant violation is untenable. Dima.
Well, it reminds me of a phrase by Madeleine Albright before the war in Yugoslavia. She said, I'm not talking about war here. I'm talking about the use of force. And then she added, that's a very important distinction. Well, I think this is very dangerous when you have
What is the distinction, Dima?
None.
Okay. Not international law, maybe in her mind.
Well, an undeclared war, an attack like Japan attacked the United States without declaring a war in December 1941, that's what it is. You know, you use force without officially declaring war. That's much worse than declare a war and attack another country. So this is just very responsible, and that was the reaction from the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, that the United States simply, the U.S. officials simply don't understand how serious their remarks are, with what serious matters they're playing, you know.
Okay, well, let's keep going with serious remarks here. Let's go to Ryan Zeke. He's the Interior Secretary.
In charge of national parks.
Okay, he's got a lot more on his plate here, apparently. The United States has the ability with our Navy to make sure the sea lanes are open and, if necessary, to blockade to make sure that their energy, Russia's energy, does not go to market. Glenn, a blockade is an act of war under international law.
Yeah, so this is twice in 1 week the United States have threatened Russia with war, which is quite extraordinary. But it also shows that, this is how all great powers often behave.
Misbehave.
But how they're able to exert force, because the United States, ever since World War II, has been able to control most of the most strategic maritime corridors. So from Panama Canal to the Malacca Strait or the Persian Gulf. So obviously during peacetime this is a way of having commercial benefit or moving troops easily or a good way of getting allies, but during times of crisis or decline this is when you essentially cut off adversaries from trade routes and try to starve their economies to death, and that's why we refer to them as choke points. And it's quite again extraordinary they would threaten this against Russia as well. And I think it's also related.
In my introduction, I said, is the Trump doctrine being revealed? Because we have in 1 week, we have the threatening military force against a nuclear power, Russia. Both countries are in the negotiations over these weapons here. Both sides accuse the other of violations. And then we have basically, this is just an extension of Trump's trade war. But if you combine it, this kind of comes together with a great power's vision of the world. Mark, you were in the Navy, so...
I'd like to point out that even the threat of an attack, of an aggression against Russia, is technically an act of aggression and a violation of international
law. Prohibited
by the United Nations Charter. Now, as a former U.S. Navy man, I have to say that I think what the very knowledgeable about such matters Secretary of the Interior here, and I'm being a little facetious, has revealed a dangerous new capability of the U.S. Navy. They have evidently equipped their ships with a transforming land shark attack so that U.S. Navy ships can now go off the sea into the land to blockade Russia's energy supplies, which the vast majority of are pipelines.
Right.
Russia
right.
ships. Energy, the vast majority, I mean, it does do some LNG, it does some oil by tanker, but the vast majority of Russia's energy to market goes to Europe
right.
or China via pipelines. So that is the only way I can interpret his remarks.
You know, but the interesting thing is that this is, and it's not just Russia. We're looking at China, and of course we have the Iran sanctions looming here, which we hopefully will be able to talk about here. I mean, this is the U.S. determining how countries trade, who they can trade with, mm-hmm. and essentially what kind of relationships they have with other countries.
Yeah, bypassing the United Nations. And this is very important. Not only China and Russia are getting sick of it. You know, during President Putin's visit to India this week, the Indians let it be understood very clearly that if sanctions were not improved, were not approved by the Security Council of the
which
United Nations.
Which it won't be. Which it won't be.
Which they are not. We are not going to apply them. We are not going to, you know, they mean nothing to us. And that was the message from India, which has been basically kind of an ally of the United States during
it's
the
been
last...
It's moving closer.
Yes, during the last 3 or 4 years. So people are getting really sick of Trump doctrine, if we call we can call it that. You know, Trump, during his presence in the United Nations building, he said, first, I want to talk to the Venezuelan president, as if forgetting that just a few days ago, he basically threatened intervention. Right?
Right.
So this is the Trump's doctrine.
No, it's really, I'm glad you brought that up. I want to talk to the Venezuelan ambassador.
Well, I said a few days ago I want to make a deal.
And the Iranians will come to me. They will come to me to make a deal, while at the same time they're doing everything they can in their power to overthrow that existing regime.
So, and Joe Biden, the Bolton said openly during his meeting with the Iranian opposition that we want to undermine the Iranian government. We don't want it to live to the 40th anniversary of its revolution.
The Iranian opposition, meaning the Mujahideen-e Kal.
Exactly. Right.
Yes, exactly. Which is only until only it took Hillary Clinton to take them off the international terrorists.
And I'm sorry, yeah. Mr. Zinke, who is in charge of national parks, made this remark about Russian energy, about the blockade, talking about fracking in the United States, defending that strategy, which is environmentally very questionable.
Right.
Yeah, I think that points out how confusing, I guess, how domestic politics is influencing their foreign policy. But I would point out that this effort to go after so many countries at the same time, it undermines the strategy. Because, again, the main strategy or the main country to isolate for America would ideally be China, I would assume, given that they're the main
rival.
But
they have other things, other fish to fry.
Well, only this week the European Union announced that they would establish common mechanisms in cooperation with China and Russia to try to bypass both the U.S. dollar and the transaction
Swiss
system. Yeah.
Right.
So, and of course, the Indians might want to throw in their currency as well there, because obviously they're starting to feel a bit uneasy as well. So I think that is a problem by trying to isolate everyone at the same time. They could be isolating themselves and giving up a key privilege, which
exactly.
is...
Exactly. I mean, if you look at American hegemony in the world, you know, it's not just the military, it's the financial system. And if people are starting to move away from it, then they're devaluing the value of the dollar.
Yeah, I'd like to say that, Dimitri, I think that you are understating because the U.S., when you're talking about fracking, because the U.S. mainstream media has clearly reported in the last few weeks that the only reason there's any opposition to the pollution and protest against fracking in the United States is because of Russian trolls or a Russian plot. I mean, it's all inspired. I mean, the people in Pennsylvania and across the U.S. who have brown, dirty water that you can literally set on fire and earthquakes being caused.
And they don't even call it fracking. They call it now hydraulic fracturing. Okay. It's like you're not a short person anymore. You are vertically challenged.
It was always called that. But anyway.
40 seconds, Mark.
Yeah. I think the belligerent rhetoric, when we're talking Ryan Zinke, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, Nikki Haley, Trump promising fire and fury, we're looking at a truly ignorant and incompetent administration blundering, blustering belligerently its way through a foreign policy into destroying the reputation of the United States. So go team.
Well, the thing is that the U.S. wants to isolate certain countries, but ultimately it's isolating itself.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And I want to discuss something Mark sent me just before we sat down here from the Washington Monthly, an article. This is quite fascinating. Crosstalk is not supposed to be a comedy program, but maybe we'll have some comedy here. How the Republicans in Russia are remaking the Supreme Court. Now, Mark sent this to me because, well, it's kind of an, what did you call it, a Russiagate peak? Is that what you called it?
I think it's obviously, we're not there yet.
Obviously. All right. And it's written by a gentleman named John
Storr.
Okay. Yeah. Just some snippets here. While it is still unclear whether Trump colluded, and then we have parentheses, with the Mueller probe, when completed, will tell us more. It is likely the Russian saboteurs turned the election in favor, in his favor, Trump's. James Clapper, the former intel chief, said as much. Go further. From the Kremlin's point of view, the best way to weaken our country is to increase the power of our most undemocratic branch. You sent it to me, Mark. Your reaction.
I think this reveals the true intent of the Russian operation to put the Manchurian candidate Trump into office. And this was to take over the Supreme Court of the United States, Brett Kavanaugh, you know. I don't really know how to take this. This is pure insanity. It is a product of a fevered and delusional mind who wants to imagine anyone who disagrees with him politically, like, say, the Supreme Court justice in the United States that was just appointed, whom I am no fan of myself for political rather than, say, beer reasons. We are seeing such insanity. Not only does he actually question the legitimacy of Brett Kavanaugh,
but many others as well.
He references the work, and he says the work he references in the article claims that all five conservative members of the Supreme Court are illegitimate. All right, this is just wow.
And it's Russia for the last.
Well, he obviously embraced drinking beer before.
The author embraced beer writing this. Okay, I can go with that.
There is another hilarious quote from there. He's quoting someone named Kathleen Hoh Jamison, who is a legend in the political circles of Washington. Russians persuaded enough people in the right states to vote a certain way. And on the same day, we have this revelation from the U.S. court that they're indicting seven more Russian intelligence officers. So we had 13 indicted a few months ago. Now we have seven more. 20 people persuaded 300 million Americans in the right states to vote in a certain way, or, she writes, persuaded people not to vote at all. So if 20 people could do that to millions, then they are geniuses, you know. And who is going to protect us from all of that? Jeff Sessions, you know, that person of great integrity.
That has been recused.
Yes.
Okay.
His reaction to this news about Russian hackers indicted. State-sponsored hacking and disinformation campaigns pose serious threats to our security and to our open society, but the Department of Justice is defending against them. End of quote from Jeff Sessions.
I had totally forgotten that he was still around. Anyway,
and they forgot that James Clapper, whom the author of this article, John Stewart, quotes as an ultimate authority on Russians, he said that Russians are genetically inclined to penetrate and interfere.
No, Nikki Haley says more or less the same thing. Glenn, go ahead, jump in.
I think the reason why this is becoming a bit of a comedy is because this the Russiagate thing, it works. I mean, let's not forget how this all started with Hillary Clinton. It was, of course, revealed that they were passing over questions during town hall meetings, and essentially, they colluded. So, and since then, Russia can really be blamed for everything. And of course, there's some serious cases, but now it's going to walk into the comedy section. question as well, because if you remember, well, my favorite, I think, was last week, was blaming the poor Star Wars movie on the Kremlin, because, you know, the Russian bots were out there giving
one size fits all.
Well, to undermine Western culture. And but probably my favorite of all was George Takei, the Star Trek actor. Like, he was accused of sexual harassment, and essentially he turned around saying, well, that a lot of this online traffic is obviously Russian bots, and because he's you know, been quite outspoken about LGBT rights, Putin took a personal offense to it, so Putin's coming after him. So he sent out this tweet to try to reassure everyone, dear friends, let me just reassure you that I will stand up against, even though the Russians are coming for me, I will continue to fight for you. So so he went from being a sexual, you know, predator to essentially being a victim and fighter for justice. So so the Russiagate works.
That Russian model in the UK that apparently was slipped a rat poison, you know, and she made the cover of some tabloid.
To be fair, the mainstream media obviously nailed this one on the head, because they're obviously monitoring my Twitter account, because I indeed posted a negative review of The Last Jedi. I thought it was complete garbage.
Is that the one we saw together?
No, that was Solo, and I liked that one.
Sorry.
The critics hated it. So, again, my attempt to make people believe that Solo was a good movie was obviously a Kremlin bot influence operation, me being one of the most well-known Kremlin influence bots, I guess. Is there anything that you don't like in the U.S. that you can now deny the agency of everyone and everyone else and claim that Boris and Natasha are responsible for it?
All the claims of meddling in American politics, but at the same time, the United States openly talks about meddling in the politics of countries all over the world. Iran is the best example. Rudy Giuliani, during the General Assembly, walked across the street and was saying, you know, regime change 2019. I mean, there's no introspection. There's no self-reflection.
That's bipartisan, because Nancy Pelosi is talking to the MEK as well, and everyone gets behind talk of overthrowing the government in Venezuela, Iran. The U.S. meddling is ubiquitous, and at the same time, European leaders during the election, several European leaders, not only used their state media that was extremely biased against Trump, but several EU leaders openly, publicly endorsed Hillary Clinton. Yeah. How many minds did they meddle and influence with? How many minds did the Italian prime minister convince with his endorsement of Hillary Clinton for Hillary Clinton during the election?
There is no evidence of their core claims after 2 years, Dima.
But, let's suppose I'm a person who believes the mainstream press. Then I should believe that two Russian agents poisoned the Skripals on the 4th of March, and then somehow the bottle with that poisonous substitute, substance, lived until the 27th of June, was used by two homeless persons in another town, Amesbury. Then I'm supposed to believe that's a statement from the British Foreign Office that Britain for the first time identified four cyber attacks as Russian sourced. They include attacks against the Kiev Metro, Odessa Airport, Russia's Central Bank, and now institutions in the UK.
The Russian Central Bank, did you say?
Yes. They are accusing Russian intelligence of attacking not only the British and Dutch and American objects, including some nuclear fuel processing factory in Pittsburgh.
Are they saying that the Russian Central Bank is an object of U.S. influence in Russia? I'm confused.
We're going into dangerous areas.
Time Magazine at the end of the year is going to be the Russian bot. That's the figure of the year.
My logic is, The Western media declared Elvira Nabiullina, the chairman of the Russian Central Bank, the best central banker in the world. There was a very positive article in the Wall Street Journal about her. And then the Russian hackers decided to attack her.
Well, I think that immediately after the Cold War, there was an interesting piece in New York Times. I think it was in 1993. It was one of the leaders of National Endowment for Democracy, one of the sponsors of democracy. He essentially made the argument that a lot of what they did during the Cold War covertly could now be done overtly in the name of democracy. So they didn't have to hide themselves anymore. So essentially, if you see a government which isn't well defined by U.S. democratic, then you can do whatever you want to topple it.
And Saudi Arabia.
It's government funded. Okay.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, they were fearful they were going to lose their funding, and then Trump flipped on it, and they got more money.
One can always make a good argument for promoting democracy, but I think at the heart of it, the problem is that it undermines the entire concept of international law, because in international law, there has to be reciprocity. I mean, if I give up my flexibility, I will expect the same from you. So the problem here is, of course, that the West, as you know, the stewards of democracy, can then say that no, this is only us because we're the democracy, so we can go and topple governments. And
are you saying allegedly Russia, through WikiLeaks, exposing that the Democratic primary was rigged by Hillary Clinton and the DNC, that is a legitimate act of democratization?
It's not. Well, Kenneth Waltz, okay, is the godfather of neorealism, political theory. He made the argument that he was concerned about the West after the Cold War, because he said we don't consider ourselves good because what we do, but we consider ourselves good because who we are.
Yes.
And essentially, so we can topple a democratically elected president in Ukraine and as a way to promote democracy, and it will still be okay because who we are.
Since the Cold War, when and where has it worked? Still waiting, Dima.
Well, I think there is an important exception, and Glenn mentioned it. It's Saudi Arabia. We had a hilarious...
Qatar, Bahrain.
Yes, but we had a hilarious statement from Mr. Trump this week. I love the king, King Salman. But I said, King, we're protecting you. You might not be there for 2 weeks without us. You have to pay for your military. End of quote. That is Mr. Trump talking to that champion of democracy.
And the crown prince said what?
The crown prince said, I think it was very revealing what he said. We buy everything with money. I think that's a hilarious answer, because they not only buy
with
arms,
oil,
they also buy good image, because despite Prince Bin Salman's actions, the Western press is not critical of him. We all remember how Thomas Friedman was exhausted, worn out by a long complimentary interview with him.
Such an embarrassment.
You know.
Okay, gentlemen, we're right on this, that very embarrassing moment. We end on this here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening.